Good afternoon. Who can explain nuclear fission in 7 minutes? He went 2 minutes over, but that's pretty damn good, I have to say. Good afternoon. I'm John Defterios. Nice to be in London, where I'm living today. Richard, Cecile, thank you for the invitation as well. I feel like I've been living in the nuclear space because just 2 weeks ago, I was chairing the Nuclear Energy Forum in Abu Dhabi and had a chance to visit the Barakah plant there. And often overlooked here in the UK is the development both in Egypt and Saudi Arabia of nuclear power, even though it's the number one oil exporter in the world. There's plenty of energy, but it's a good diversification of energy sources. Our session here is a fantastic one. And first, I want to thank the FII for going into this space. And what I mean here is making the link between the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, and ESG, Environmental Social Governance. The two are very far apart today, but as the former emerging markets editor of CNN, I find it extraordinary that no one before the FII went in and said, how do you achieve net zero by 2050 without the developing world? We heard some figures thrown around this morning about 750 million people, believe it or not, don't have access to energy on a daily basis. More than 2 billion have intermittent access to energy. It's extraordinary. So 10% don't have access to energy at all. So unless we get this formula correct and to accelerate it, again, we had the discussion this morning talking about the pace of change. It's alarming because I cover the energy transition, how far behind we are. And you think about the Rio Agreement going back 30 years ago. Have we kept the pace necessary to tackle the challenge of our lifetime, which is climate change? And I would say no. And it's great that you heard from the Lord Mayor, the ideas from Sir David on nuclear energy as well. But the pace of change needs to accelerate. And what we're looking at this afternoon is the role of financial institutions, the sovereign funds themselves, and the major fund managers of the world. I have no better than two better guests than we can have for the next half hour, and let's give them a warm welcome. First, His Excellency, the Governor of the Public Investment Fund, Yasser Al-Rumayyan, joining us from New York, and to his left, Larry Fink is the CEO of BlackRock. We just had some time together in the UAE. One manages $620 billion and is in the top five of sovereign wealth funds, and the other sits on top of $10 trillion. So what they have to say this afternoon does matter. We have a surround sound studio here. And we have to ask both of them about how they feel about today's level of risk. But the first thing I think we need to do, Your Excellency, is talk about the framework that's been established today. Richard explained it to the audience, but this inclusive ESG framework is important. Why is inclusivity so important to underline with the figures that I was talking about, with so many living without energy and the transition that we need to make now and going to 2050? Please.
I think it's important because, to start with, it's inclusive. And like what you mentioned, the accessibility to energy around the emerging markets is not in the same level of the rest of the world. So we want to introduce a framework that takes into consideration market realities and also differences to allow representation for all markets, including, of course, the emerging ones. So it will set a new global standard that measures the ESG elements that has inclusivity as its core.
Great. Let me follow up quickly, and then I'll bring Larry into the conversation. How do you make ESG work in Saudi Arabia? And I would imagine there's an information gap because most people don't realize the transition that's underway at the company you're chairman of, at Saudi Aramco, with net zero to 2050, 2060 for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia as well. But how does ESG apply to the kingdom in your view, Your Excellency?
We looked into the ESG and the environmental as part of the umbrella, which is the Vision 2030, which sets out the roadmap for the kingdom ESG. We have announced in that the kingdom of Saudi Arabia will be net zero emission by 2060. That was announced by His Royal Highness, the Crown Prince, during the launch of Saudi Green Initiative. And there we said we're going to be planting 10 million trees. We will launch a national renewable energy program to increase the share of energy renewable to 50% in 2030. We will get rid almost from all the liquids and focus on gas and renewable energy. So we're making progress in the kingdom. Also, we make progress to improve the quality of life by increasing the home ownership. I think we moved from like 47% to 60% by the year 2020. Also, Tadawul introduced ESG guidelines to improve the ESG performance of public companies. Also, in Saudi, through the BIF, we launched 7 solar and wind projects to power more than 600,000 households. So we're moving there with, I won't say full throttle, but we're starting the movement. The targets are very ambitious, but I think we're in the right, we're taking the right steps.
Great. Thank you very much. Let's bring in Larry Fink. And 2 years ago in your investment letter that is so widely watched, Larry, you said that climate risk is investment risk. I'd love you to elaborate on that. But now we have a boatload of risk, including conflict, which has hit energy supplies with Russia and Ukraine, and the level of investment that's needed to hit the net zero 2050 targets. How has your narrative changed with what's on the table in front of us right now, but also after making that statement 2 years ago?
Well, the statement is more true than ever before. Climate risk is investment risk. But in that letter, I also said any energy transition is not going to be a straight line. It has to be fair and just. We told every investor, don't divest of hydrocarbons. It is better to be working with all the companies that are in hydrocarbons, not against them. And I would say in the last 2 years, there has been a remarkable change in attitude worldwide across every energy company around the world. Mm. They understand that they have to be moving forward. And we now have issues around energy security. We do have issues around the need to have reliability of sourcing energy during the transition. And so that's what we're experiencing now. And obviously now we are witnessing rising energy prices, but that began before the Russian invasion. And so what we were seeing, many policies of mitigating supply without mitigating demand. And so this is why we have this imbalance at the moment, and the imbalance of energy has been more fortified by the Russian invasion. This will resolve itself over the next 2-3 years. Higher energy prices actually bring down the green premium. Higher energy prices is going to accelerate investing in more renewables. And importantly, we have not seen a real change in terms of investor attitude. We've seen trillions of dollars of money over time throughout the industry to be moving into more sustainable strategies. The demand now for decarbonization technology, the demand for investing in carbon capture, the demand for sequestering of hydrocarbons is just as great as ever. And so we are working with the traditional energy companies right now on all of these issues. The other issue is gas is now being recognized by the Europeans, by many other places, as a great intermediate source. If you think about it, in the last 2 years, because of the Russian invasion especially, the Europeans changed their taxonomy. Historically, gas was considered brown, and now it's considered green. I would not go so far to say it's green, but in my last letter, I talked about energy transition is something going from brown to medium brown to light brown. I mean, it is going to be a pathway unless we do find new technologies that can really make the transition fair and just. We're not there yet, and so we're going to have to evolve. And I think Saudi Arabia is playing that role. Their investments in gas and playing a role. The substitution for gas utilization for energy, for power versus oil. These are all the things that are being transitioned. And the other important issue is we are going to see a rapid increase in the utilization of hydrogen. One of the big issues that is in facing so many communities, and when we think about all the risks we have, one of the big risks is, you know, not just energy increases in prices, but food inflation. One of the strong reasons why we have food inflation right now is that fertilizer prices are up two times. And one of the big issues, most fertilizers being imported in many places from China. Gas should be playing that dramatic role in the development of localized fertilizer. And so we have to really adapt our taxonomies to fit the needs. And I think this is what's going on now. So although we're in a big transition, sometimes it's scary watching markets fall and recalibrate itself. But the reality is, you know, we are moving forward. The energy companies recognize the need to be moving forward. The development in terms of, as I said, sequestration, carbon capture, hydrogen, this is all moving forward.
Okay, good. I'm going to circle back and see with you after I bring in His Excellency again whether this energy transition slows down. It almost sounds like, Larry, you're saying it's not, that it because of pricing, it'll accelerate it. But Your Excellency, I'd like to bring in your thoughts and in your portfolio now has expanded widely over the last 5 years. You're in the top five of sovereign wealth funds. But how do you connect the dots amongst your different organizations? You're chairman of Saudi Aramco. It has that very large stake in SABIC and the other industrial groups inside the economy itself. How do you bring these things together to have that commonality or the thread that runs through these companies?
The PIF is developing its ESG strategy as part of its long-term strategy. On environmental renewable as one of PIF's 13 strategic priorities sectors to enable and grow the sectors that was announced back in the 2021 vision realization program. So we have a royal decree that PIF will be responsible for developing 70% of the kingdom's renewable energy in Vision 2030. So we acquired a big percentage in Aqua Power, and which is a listed company now, and its main function is to reach the 70% stake of PIF. We also invested in many other companies like, for example, Lucid is part of our long-term strategy. Also, PIF introduced recently the MENA Regional Voluntary Carbon Market, which is very, very important thing for us, I think. If you look at Aramco or SABIC, or some of the other companies, they're doing a lot now in the carbon capture, and they have a lot of carbon credits. If we want to talk about the carbon circular economy, we need to build the tools, and this is one of the main tools. And I think to have the carbon voluntary platform in Saudi Arabia is by itself a statement for this change and for the new reality. So we will get companies to, if they're not doing anything to improve the emission, they would have to go and buy some of these carbons. So it's like balancing carbon credits. So it's like balancing what they should do and what they're doing right now. If it hits them in their P&L, they will do more to reduce the their emission. Also, in PIF, we did the integrated the green finance. We issued the green bonds and invest in existing green projects. I will give some examples. In NEOM, Amala, and Ritzy, they're not only financing through the green initiatives, but all of their energy is basically green energy. NEOM announced, I think, a year ago, the largest green hydrogen project with Aqua Power and Air Products, a project size of about $5 billion. Now, going back to the colors of, hydrogen, like brown, blue, or green. Of course, hydrogen is colorless. It doesn't have any color, but the means to produce it is what really matters to us. Also, PIF is now establishing a new hydrogen company, and it's going to be like a mediator between many of our initiatives. Aramco is also looking into carbon sequestration and the the CCUS, which is the carbon capture, utilization, and storage. So the initiatives are going in different directions. One other example on social is Roshan, one of our portfolio companies that we've established a few years ago, is increasing the home ownership rates to 70%. They're creating some new jobs, and also we're targeting in PIF 1.8 million jobs by the year 2050. For the governance side of the ESG also, PIF is one of the founding members of One Planet Sovereign Wealth Fund Working Group that is led by President Macron. And we've been working with them from the very beginning. Now it's getting more attraction. I think BlackRock recently joined a year ago to the group. PIF also continues to enhance its ESG integration across all the all of its portfolio, and I gave some of the examples for this integration.
Great, that's a lot of dots that were connected in the answer there. I have to say, it's quite a portfolio. I always wonder if the sovereign wealth funds can handle such a bandwidth, but you've proven otherwise. We only have 14 minutes left, so I'm going to ask both of you to try to keep your answers to 2 minutes. I have about 3 to 4 topics each I'd love to cover. Larry, I said I'd circle back on the energy transition. It seems like the pendulum swings too far one direction. So when we had the pandemic and everybody saw the emissions reduction that we had university endowments and the pension funds in the United States didn't want to touch, the international oil companies are now transforming to international energy companies. Can't we map a little bit better than this so you don't have these wild swings of money leaving the hydrocarbon producers and then we swing back and now energy security is a top priority? Shouldn't we be a little bit more sophisticated than that?
I don't think it's that broad. Yes, there are some visible incidents where some people divested of hydrocarbons. We as a company, we have $180 billion invested in hydrocarbon companies. Of course, it's not our money. We provide choice to our clients. We try to educate our clients as to where they should place their money. We strongly believe that climate risk is investment risk, but it has to be managed over the course of a long period of time. So I don't see that broad shift in and out. I think there's a great consistency. I think the mistake that people are looking at, though, the biggest issue that's confronting every energy company is a question of investing in deep water energy. Break evens for deep water energy could be as long as 10, 15 years. And the question is, are you going to need oil 10 or 15 years, 20 years, 30 years? That's where you're seeing less investments. When you look at the dramatic drop in investing, a lot of it is the lack of investing in deep water. But in terms of investing towards, let's say, fracking in the United States and other places, and probably eventually in Argentina and other places, the break-even in fracking is 1 or 2 years. And so the big issue in the United States related to energy, where we went from 13 million barrels down to 11, and now we're up to 11.8 million barrels a day, the big issue is we don't have pipelines. We don't have pipelines that move the energy. And if we had more pipelines in the Permian Basin, we'd be shipping more gas and other items as we've built up some LNG plants. We don't have the adequacy of pipelines in the Marcellus or in Pennsylvania, which is one of the biggest gas-producing areas in the world. And so I don't see that big shift. Obviously, the press likes to talk about these big dramatic shifts. We really haven't seen it. Probably the biggest shift we continue to see is more and more money is moving into more sustainable strategies. And that is a fact. And I do believe over the long run, some of these strategies are going to be proven to be quite successful. Some may not, but that's true with any investment in new technologies.
Okay, good. Very quickly, Larry, before I bring in His Excellency again, we can't get a bill passed in Congress for the kind of green infrastructure fund, right? And you're suggesting that our infrastructure, even around the hydrocarbons, is not sufficient. Do we respond fast enough or not? Does this just not happen in a divided Congress?
Oh, well, a few weeks ago, I did host a dinner with some hydrocarbon companies and some NGOs, and one of the most important senators came and joined me. And we had a very good conversation. The key to move anything forward is talking with each other, to each other, not around, not below, not above. And so we're trying to play a role that we are bringing in the sides from the very large NGOs, the very large environmental groups, working alongside the very large energy companies and creating a pathway. And this key senator played a big role. And this senator is really trying to push a new bill within the United States to create a pathway for decarbonization at the same time have a fair and just transition. Those are the two things that we need to be doing, and every country needs to be doing this. And I think Saudi Arabia is playing a very big role in that type of pathway. But, you know, unfortunately, that pathway is littered with other issues, geopolitical risk and all these other issues that we have to adapt. The most important thing I have to say is, as investors, we should always assume that it's not going to be a straight line. We should always assume we're going to have new risks. Now, we may not have ever anticipated the risks that we're facing now related to a war and a humanitarian disaster. But, we are adapting and we're all trying to move forward. And most importantly, we all need to be working together, country by country, to work together to create that proper decarbonization pathway. At the same time, making sure that any transition is fair and just. And that means working with energy companies, investing in energy companies that may have a short period of time of return on capital. The bigger question will be, is that enough? Do we need to ultimately invest in deep water? A big question there, and a lot of the NGOs would disagree with anything I'm going to say now. We have to just make sure, do we have adequacy in energy? At the same, and they keep the world moving to help the emerging markets, at the same time developing new technologies so we could leapfrog some of the hydrocarbon issues and really make, for instance, the emerging world to have its adequacy and power in a fair and just way.
Yeah, it's a good way of putting it. I mean, even during the COVID-19 pandemic, we were very slow to respond to the challenge of those in the developing world, especially Africa. Yasser Al-Rumayyan, we forgot to say that as a chairman of Saudi Aramco, what are you doing with ESG within that organization? I thought it was fascinating. They set an earlier target for net zero 2050. Share what the conversation is inside the company, because it has a bigger role outside of energy within the kingdom as well. How can they be a persuasive agent for change when it comes to ESG?
It's the ESG and... the net zero policy that we have in Aramco is part of what we have in Saudi Arabia. So we announced that we will be net zero emission by 2050, and the country as a whole will be net zero emission by 2060. So it's like integrated part of what's happening in the government. And Aramco, of course, has taken the leadership in both strategic and operational approach to address the ESG. So the oil and gas industry has role to play, and we have to navigate a more sustainable future for the oil and gas to be part of the energy mix. And it is actually, it will be for many, many decades to come. So the hydrocarbon products are the building blocks of the energy transition. And the problem I think that we've faced over the past few years is people wanted to switch on and off, you know, from the carbon, the fossil fuel directly to the renewable energy. We just can't do it. It's a process like what Larry said in many events, including today. You cannot just turn on and off the switch from fossil fuel to renewable energy. So so it's again a process that we need to take. So to achieve the net zero ambition isn't just a climate imperative, it's a business imperative. Aramco is in a strong position with the lowest upstream carbon intensity for major producers. So exploring low carbon energy solution, carbon, hydrogen, and cleaner fuels, the energy efficiency through technology and our massive economies of scale, the future or further reducing our gas flaring. And we did that like, I think, a decade ago, ahead of the industry. We're also, in Aramco, we're investing in renewable, like the Sudair solar PV project. As I said earlier, we're investing in the carbon capture, utilization, and storage. We're becoming a pioneer there, and I think this will lead us to the blue hydrogen, and I think we will be a major, we will be the major player in the world when it comes to the blue hydrogen. So, I mean, if you want to just add up the things that we're doing right now in Aramco and the amount of capex that we have, not only in the fossil fuel and the oil and gas, but in the other initiatives like solar and hopefully the blue hydrogen and many more initiatives down there.
Okay, thanks very much. I actually saw your CCUS facility in the Eastern Province 2 years ago on the program I was doing for CNN. Larry, I think in the last 3 minutes, and I have one more question for His Excellency at the very end, I'd be really remiss not asking you about surviving the turbulence we see today. We've had almost a 20% correction, inflation at the highest level in 30 years. It's not clear whether the Fed can manage this, the U.S. central bank, to bring down inflation but not kill off growth. How much longer do we live with the turbulence, and are we almost through the worst of it? Does inflation come down naturally post-pandemic or not?
Well, there are many seeds of inflation. The seeds of inflation in the United States are really some structural issues related to immigration policy, where we have, the trend in illegal immigration has changed quite dramatically in the last 5 years. So we do have many labor shortages. We have rising wages. Our economic policy has moved away from consumerism to job creation. And so many of these things were structural seeds that were many years in the workings. And obviously, the pandemic has really showed the weaknesses of these efficient supply chains. And then obviously we have supply shocks in food and commodities and energy because of the Russian-Ukraine war. All that is leading to some really serious supply issues. If you study some of the earnings misses that came out this week from some major U.S. companies, much of their problem has to do with supply shocks. It still is more of a supply-driven inflation issue. Demand is still a little lower than it was pre-pandemic. The Federal Reserve and other central banks are all going to try to arrest this inflation and bringing it down. And I do believe it's just going to take time as companies build out redundant supply chains, which I've written about. And this is very hard for any central bank to have the tools to arrest supply-driven inflation. They have tools to arrest demand-driven inflation. That's what they do. And so that's going to be the balance. You know, how much do they raise interest rates that creates a reduction in demand and puts economies into recession? I don't think they're going to have to go as high as some of the future interest rate curve suggests. China is already in a recession by evidence of the most recent information. You do have many issues around the world. So the S&P has been reset. We were trading at a premium above a 30-year average in terms of the PE averages. We are now at the 30-year average of a price-earnings ratio for equities. We've seen the indexes do not really show the damage, as you suggested, because energy companies are part of the index. They're up on the year, and you have a lot of tech companies down 50, 60, 70% down. So we reset many, many stock. The big issue is going to be E. In many of the companies that reported in the last 2 days, they reported that that their margins have been really compromised by the supply shocks, and they were not passing on the same price increases despite how high inflation is. And so that would be the big issue. If one believes we can mitigate these supply shocks over the next year and mitigate some of these issues, then I would say earnings can resume to be strong. But if supply shocks continue over the next 12 months, we're probably going to have some earnings misses that are going to be continuing, which suggests markets have some more ways to go down. But as a long-term investor, these are great opportunities to buy. There are many cheap stocks now. But if you're a day trader, you may want to wait. But, no one could pick bottoms. No one could pick tops. The reality is the market has reset itself. And I would say for those companies that you really believe have a bright, strong future, you may see those stocks going down a little bit, but I would suggest this is the time to start adding to your portfolio.
Interesting. Okay, thanks for taking that. Your Excellency, the last question to you, and we're over time already, but I wanted to get the spirit of your influence with better than $600 billion under management in the top five. If I took the top 15 sovereign funds, it's $8 trillion. How does that money influence the acceleration of ESG? You have this index today that's inclusive. How does it, affect what we see as trends in the world? Can you do it in a minute? Then I'm going to round this up. Thanks.
I'll try. I think by the end of this year, $41 trillion in assets will be ESG screened. And are expected to top $50 trillion by the year 2025. So integrating the ESG needs to be inclusive and based on different market realities and the creation of the FII's inclusive ESG framework that we've announced today and the scoring methodology, it's very, very important to encourage the investments in emerging markets and tap into opportunities that benefit people and the planet. So we should be working together through many things, and I'll give an example like the One Planet Sovereign World Fund's working group.
Okay, very good. You did it in a minute. I appreciate that. It's good to see you again. We have you on a very big screen, you and Larry, so you're larger than life in our studios. First, let's give a round of applause, and I'm going to ask everybody to stay in their seats. His Excellency Yasser Al-Rumayyan and Larry Fink of BlackRock. Gentlemen, And we have a special thanks. Let's bring in the CEO of the Future Investment Initiative Institute, Richard, please.
Thank you, John. No, I just take 1 minute. I would like to thank really Larry. Thank you very much for being with us. Your Excellency, dear Yasser, I know how important it is today. And so thank you for starting your day in New York with us. But also, I cannot, you know, we are family here. We miss you. Really, we miss you very much in London. But I know it's for good cause. So please, on behalf of our family, I would like you to thank really Faisal, your son, for his graduation today at NYU, and tell him how much we are proud of him. Thank you, Your Excellency. Thank you, Larry. All the best.